Tonight we're going to talk about a very fascinating character, Pilate. There is quite a lot said about him if you think in terms of trying to cover a very large amount of material in a very few pages. Proportionately, Pilate gets quite a lot of attention here in this narrative about the crucifixion. So we do well to pay attention to him. I don't think we can take Pilate frivolously. I think that there are a lot of people who sense that he is sort of a civic clown because he is on the dais there in the Praetorium as the governor under Rome, but still a puppet in most respects, and probably having sold out considerably to get there. People tend not to take him too seriously, but if you read this text, you have to take him seriously. The interesting thing is, the only way you know to take Pilate seriously is a little three-letter word. If you wouldn't know the Greek language, you wouldn't know to take Paul Pilate seriously. Well, that's what a teacher's for. I don't mean to say that you can't know the Bible without a teacher. I mean, you can read the Bible and get lots of things out of it without a teacher. But there's some things you just have to have some help on because this is a language that we are not familiar with. And no translation, I think there isn't a translation available today, except the one that you are receiving from us, that will bring out this point of why you have to take Pilate seriously. I mean, translate it in that way. But we'll see that as we go along. So I do not see him as a clown or as a con artist, deceiver, cynic. Maybe cynical in many respects, but not with Jesus. Well, we'll proceed with the story of Pilate and see what comes up here. Verse 28. They led Jesus then from Caiaphas onto the Praetorium, and it was early in the morning. Now, the Praetorium is the seat of the governor. Could be a palace, hall of justice, so to speak, but it was probably the palace. And it was very early in the morning,
or right at dawn.
But they themselves did not enter into the Praetorium. That is, the people that were leading Jesus there were Jewish people, Jewish priests and leaders, Pharisees. They themselves did not enter into the Praetorium in order that they may not be tarnished, but they would eat the feast. By their law, if they walked into the palace of the Gentile dog of a governor, that they would be contaminated, and therefore they couldn't eat the feast, which was coming up. The Passover feast was now at hand. So Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring to this man?" Now, Pilate is in a very difficult spot. I'm not sure that I can tell you why he's there. It's speculative. When I say a difficult spot, I mean that to man the little province of Judea was no big plum from the Caesars. It was a dusty, brawling little area where the Jews were always causing trouble of one kind or another. It was a powder keg, could blow at any moment because the Jews hated the Romans, hated Caesar, although they don't give that evidence here. They had been so abused by them in so many respects that it is not no wonder that they hated them. But the reason for the abuse was not because they were worshiping God. There was no problem with the Roman government in worshiping God because they had many gods. The more the merrier. They brought the Greek gods in there when they took over the Greeks in about 146 B.C., I think it was, and he took over the Greeks. They brought the Greek whole pantheon of gods right in there. In fact, you find Greek names and Roman names or Latin names side by side for all these gods. Jupiter and Zeus were co-equals and so forth. So the Romans had no problem with somebody else's god. But the one problem they had was that they would not allow one god. And that, of course, was the Jews' main stock and trade, one god. And they would let you take any other god plus Caesar. And the Jews, of course, were not about to do that. So constantly they were on the verge of insurrection, of rebellion. And therefore, that province that Pilate governed was probably the least desirable of any of the provinces that he could have had. But he was there in the midst of that powder keg. So he's not really the friend of these Jews very much. And he hates this nasty business at this hour of the morning, tries to get out of it, but he only tries to get out of it before he meets Jesus, before he really encounters him. Because the moment he encountered Jesus, from that time on, he sought to get him released. You see that? Here in the first, what does it say? In almost 5 minutes, he sees the man and walks out where these Jews are and says, take him, do whatever you want with him, I don't care. Don't bother me with this thing. Pilate doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want the Jews to be there. He hates the Jews. He hates Caesar. He hates everybody. And he doesn't want to mess with this nasty business. So he says to them, what accusation do you have? They said, if he were not an evildoer, we would not have brought him to you. A very harsh or nasty answer to a nasty question. It's just a very rough little scene here that's going on. It's not like the scene in the hall of the high priest. They're having their fun in there, but the pilot, this is not a fun thing for Pilate. He doesn't want it at all. Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. And the Jews said, it is not lawful for us to kill anyone. They're very precise about the law until it comes to the truth. They hate the truth and love the law. Very nice ring to that. I mean, we see it in a lot of other circles. So he says, it's not law for us to kill anyone. In order that the word of Jesus may be fulfilled, signifying what sort of death that he was about to die. In other words, there was going to be a death. They were sure of that. They did not come to Pilate to get a judgment against Jesus to throw him into prison for a few months or years. They came for death. And they were certain, before this whole mess was over, that they would have their death. And that, as it says, Jesus knew he was going to die, so this fulfilled that point. Pilate entered in again into the praetorium, or the palace, if you will, called Jesus and said to him. Now, when it says he called Jesus, he isn't, he's up, he's, Pilate is a ways away from Jesus. He's not sitting right beside him. So he calls out in this hall of judgment to him, and he says, are you the king of the Jews? Now, he just asks it. He has no preconceived notion about Jesus at this point. The way this question is asked in the Greek text, and I have to be a little bit technical here. Just pure question. No inclination one way or the other. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered him, do you say this from yourself, or has another said to you concerning me? In other words, the question here is well taken by Jesus, because Pilate would not have had too much interaction with Jesus at all, and he would not and the Jews didn't give him any particular accusation. So Pilate doesn't have any preconditioning here. It's an interesting question because he hasn't been studying up on Jesus. He doesn't even know Jesus, and he doesn't care whether Jesus is there or not. Here's a man in front of him that the Jews have brought, and they've got some crazy question about the law regarding this man, and he doesn't know him from Adam. So he just, somewhere this thing came. Now Jesus brings that out. Incidentally, I want to say to you that when Jesus was in the under the judgment of the priests, he didn't say anything, except on occasion he made a statement, but again and again you find the words, Jesus answered them nothing. Nothing. He wouldn't talk to those chief priests. Now, you're going to find that the fact that Jesus enters into a discussion with Pilate shows that he respects him to a degree. That shows that he is interested in him. Or he wouldn't have talked to him. And the same is true with Nicodemus. When Nicodemus came as a Pharisee to talk to Jesus, Jesus was very open with him. But the other Pharisees who were just trying to bait him, he wouldn't even talk to them. Now there was a point at which he didn't answer Pilate, but that was a special issue. So here he is, he confronts this man. I think Jesus, this is kind of speculative, but I think Jesus was sympathetic with the position this man was in. And it's not really speculative. There are lines that show me that. Jesus was sympathetic with Pilate's position. After all, Pilate did not come from any kind of a background that he could have been expected to know anything. He was a Gentile. He couldn't have been expected to know anything. He would have to come under the broad grace of God to be helped, even, see. So he's caught in the system of the Roman government, and there's not much he can do about it, and he didn't know anybody when he got stuck in it. So Jesus has, I think, some sympathy for this man, Pilate. So when Pilate asks him, "Are you a king?" Jesus is in effect saying, "Well, that's rather an interesting question. I'm not sure I know why you're asking me that. You know, where do you get the idea that I was supposed to be a king?" That gives me the sense that something has been going on in Pilate's mind here. Now, it isn't altogether that Pilate never heard of Jesus. His wife, in fact, knew Jesus better than Pilate and sent a message to him when Jesus was there in the hall with him. And she said, "I suffered a lot of things because of a dream about this man. So leave him alone. He's a just man." And Pilate probably didn't ignore that. I think it helped to kind of confirm in his own mind what was going on there. So remember now, in the first instance, when Pilate first just comes to Jesus, or Jesus comes to Pilate, there's nothing there. Here's a man that's brought in on some little technicality of the law of the Jews, and he doesn't know him. But now, he confronts Jesus, and that confrontation is very dynamic, and that has been true throughout all the narratives of the life of Jesus. The confrontation with a person has brought a response. Now, sometimes it was a negative response. The rich young ruler went away sorrowful because he didn't want to do what Jesus said, but he knew what Jesus was talking about. Here and there, though, there were those that confronted the truth and turned away from it. Herod was one of these. He confronted the thing, turned away from it. He confronted it in John the Baptist. And turning away from John the Baptist and letting him be slain was the death knell for Herod. He made his choice. Before that, he was open. The Gospels are very clear about that Herod was open to John. The confrontation with Jesus at every point brought a response, one way or the other. If one turns toward Jesus, immediately the Spirit of God comes to the aid and draws the heart out. If you turn away from Jesus, immediately the spirit is withered in that respect. That is, it begins to fade. So you, when you confront Jesus, you have a choice to make. Nobody ignores Jesus. You confront him, you either follow him or you turn away from him. But nobody ignores him. So Pilate is now confronting Jesus. Very dramatic scene here. Where Pilate comes face to face with the Son of God. With God himself, in fact. And Pilate is in a contest here, in a way. So Jesus says, "Did you hear this from yourself, or did others say it to you?" Pilate answered him, "I'm not a Jew, am I?" He's saying, "Well, how would I know? I don't know. How do I know? I'm not a Jew. This is a Jewish matter." He said, "Your nation and priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" I think this question of Pilate's must have slipped out. I don't see it as something he meditated on or premeditated. Just slipped out. Here he's confronting a man and suddenly he feels that he's in front of a king. And it slips out. "Are you a king?" So he said, "What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. For if my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, in order that I may not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not of this world." All right, now this is a powerful statement. I'm going to have to deal with it a little bit before we go on with Pilate. Because it gets right down where you live. Jesus is saying, if my kingdom were of this world, I would be spared this tragedy. And I would have resources to handle it that I could call upon. But this is not what I came for, to be spared from earthly tragedies. This is not my world. Whatever is done to me here in this world is done. And I'm not going to stop it. Now the reason that gets down to where we live is this. If we belong to Christ and we're in his kingdom, our kingdom is not of this world, right? And if Jesus does not send his troops to deliver us or spare us from tragedy, it is because it is not his chief purpose in our lives to spare us from tragedy in this world. He does not spare the Christian people of this world. That is what disturbs me about recent trends in religion. They're not only recent, but I mean they've been more prominent recently. That seem to lead people to the conclusion that if they're of Jesus' kingdom, he's going to make things nice. He's going to deliver them from all sorrows and tragedies. And if they have any sorrows, it's their fault because they don't have enough faith or something. Now that is, I have to say to you, even though I stand against the tide of a large segment of Christendom, I'm going to say to you that it is false. It is a false position. If you know the Bible, now if you're following the traditions, you may not come to this conclusion, but if you're following the Bible, you have to say that the trend that says the Christian should be healed or helped if he has the faith is a false trend as far as the Bible is concerned. If it weren't in the Bible, I wouldn't be saying it to you. You say, where in the Bible? Just all over the Bible. Everywhere we have Christians not spared from tragedy or heartache, and we have the Bible telling us, "Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial that is to try you as though some strange thing happened unto you." And Job says, "When I am tried, I shall come forth as gold." And just over and over again, the scripture deals with people in sorrow and doesn't take away the conditions of that sorrow. But there is peace in the midst of the sorrow. That's what the Bible promises. Not the absence of sorrow, but peace in the heart in the midst of the sorrow. So that the sorrow can almost become a bittersweet thing. Jesus Christ is never so near to you as when you're in sorrow, because he was there. He knows that story well. And he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. If Jesus was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we want to know Jesus, can we escape the cup of sorrow? If you want to know Jesus, you cannot escape the cup of sorrow. Now, that doesn't mean that you are slated for tragedies as such. It just means that when life hits you beyond your capacity to bear it, know that it hit Jesus also. At the tough, hard, gut level. And the deeper your problem, the more likely you are to find Jesus in the cup of sorrow. He's there, and you'll sense him there. Despite all the ragings that are going on within and without, you can sense Jesus deeply there, holding you. Maybe checking you, holding you back, and sustaining you, holding you up. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee, yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Your capacity to hold on in the midst of sorrow is there because Jesus Christ is in you. Psalm 147 says, he healeth the broken in heart. He telleth the stars and calleth them by name. I've given this down below, but it's a poem I got from a teacher that I had years and years ago, and he wrote it. And there is hope and help for our sighs and tears, for the wounds that sting and smart. Our God is at home with the rolling spheres and at home with the broken hearts. Isn't our ability to handle it, it isn't our ability to understand it or to reason it out. It is merely the touch of the divine presence within us that holds us and sustains us, keeps us going in the midst of the hard things. Life is full of hard things, and I wish I could spare you from it, but I can't. Now, you see this point? What am I saying here to you? Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world, else I would take steps to relieve the situation. And if you're in Jesus' kingdom, you cannot expect that necessarily you're going to be relieved from suffering any more than he was. So he does not send the troops to rescue you. He lets you sweat it out sometimes, and that's hard. But it's real. Even though the Lord does not, for our own sakes, relieve these situations, he may, for his own reasons, relieve them. In other words, he takes the prerogative to relieve the situation when he's ready to. If he believes that the situation we're in is necessary for our growth and maturity, he'll let it go as long as it needs to be. Like Lazarus, who was allowed to die, but later raised from the dead, because God had a point to make. Number two, second thing, it is always necessary and important for us to share that problem with Christ, that he may give the sustaining grace. Go through it with him. Invite him into the problem with you. He may solve it immediately if he thinks it ought to be. Now these words came through to Pilate. It penetrated. I talked today in a radio broadcast about the woman of Samaria, and was outlining something of her situation, where she had no background to really receive received Jesus' words when he came to that well. She was a Samaritan woman who knew very little of the Jewish faith. She didn't know Jesus. She was not a religionist. As a woman coming to draw water, she had very little conversation about theological matters. No background, whatever. But when Jesus hit her with his words about the water of life, whereas at first she was doubtful, by the time he got through, she asked for the water. And that meant that he got through to her. Otherwise, she'd have said, well, I haven't got time to talk further. Goodbye. I've got to take my water jar and go. But she didn't. She stopped. She was hit enough by that and understood enough to say, sir, give me that water. She had to understand it. She knew he didn't have a bucket to draw with. She said so at first. She said, you don't have a bucket to draw with. Where are you going to give me water? And all Jesus had to say is, I've got it. And you can have it if you want it. And it'll be a well of water in your life. Now, it wasn't that he was appealing to previous theological knowledge. There was something he hit her with. His word came through to her and changed her. Now, the word of Jesus came here with impact to Pilate, because he says then, verse 37, you are indeed a king, are you not? Now, you see how you can ask that question? Most of the translations will say, are you a king then? It's about how they'll read it. But you have to go this way to really pick up the text. You are indeed a king, are you not? You see, in the Greek language, you ask a question where there are three ways to ask a question in the Greek. One way, you're just asking a bald question. You have no predisposition as to how the answer might be. So Pilate's first question to Jesus, are you a king? It's like saying, do you live in Ojai? You don't know where you live. So yes or no. I don't know what the answer is. What is it? Then you can ask a question in a way that expects a negative answer. You can say, well, you surely don't live in Ojai, do you? You're expecting people to say, no, I live in Oakview. I'd never be caught dead in Ojai. You surely do not live in Ojai, do you? Or the third way is, you live in Ojai, do you not? If you're sitting in this room, you're going to say to these people that own this place, you live in Ojai, do you not? Because you're expecting them to say immediately, yes. Now, that's the way this question is asked. You only know that from the Greek text. You are a king indeed, are you not? Now, that's where I say to you that there was more to this thing of Pilate than some civil clown trying to make peace with the Jews as a Roman governor. He's moved. He's hit by this thing. Now, that being the case, we have to go on now with a story of Pilate believing that he has been hit. He's not now sarcastic. He's not cynical. He's not bitter. He's not indifferent. He has encountered Jesus, and it has made a difference, and it has hit him as it did the woman of Samaria. She went back from that well a different woman. She ran back to the village of Sychar and said, come and listen to this man. He's told me everything I've ever done. Is this not the Christ? All right, now with that basis, then we go on with the story. Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. Jesus doesn't say, anymore. Jesus is not now taking Pilate lightly. And he's not being sarcastic with him. You mean to say Jesus was ever sarcastic? Of course he was sarcastic to the Pharisees. He said a lot of things to the Pharisees that were pretty biting. And he was in some ways almost, well, I don't like to say sneering, but it might be. I mean, he was very sarcastic to the Pharisees. He wasn't the Nicodemus. Even in his very pointed questions to Nicodemus, where he says, "Are you a teacher in Israel and you don't know these things?" He's not being sarcastic. He's not putting him down. You can tell the flavor of this thing if you know it deeply enough. You have to get the flavor. You can't, these are things you can't get in a flannel graph from the Sunday school lesson. I mean, this is something pretty deep here that you've got to be sensitive to this text to get all of this flavor out of it. But you must take my word for it. This is what the Spirit of the Lord has in this text for us. So Jesus says to him, you say that I am a king. Because Jesus took it the same way I'm taking it. He doesn't even answer, if he says, "Are you a king?" He doesn't say yes. He says, "You said it, yes. You've told me that you believe that I am a king. You told me that by the way you asked." He says, "Unto this end I was born, and unto this end I have come into the world, that I may bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And you see, if a person doesn't know this text very well, they are going to say that Pilate is cynical here, and he says, "Well, who knows the truth?" And that is wrong. You might get that out of some translations, but that's not the way Pilate was asking the question. I mean, you might expect him to be that way logically. You might say, well, Pilate's been around the block a few times. He's had to come up through the ranks of the Roman hierarchy. He's had to face the hypocrisies and the persiflage and the double tongues of the world or leadership, and he is a cynic. He's bitter. You expect him to be cynical. He probably was a cynical man. He was a man jaded and cynical. He'd been around a lot, and he'd plowed, come up through the ranks, and he knew pretty much what men were made of. But I say to you, he was not being cynical when he asked Jesus about the truth. But having come this way, he really didn't know where the truth was at all. He's so much been a part of the hypocrisies and puppetries of the government order that he must indeed wonder where in the world can anyone find the truth? Now he doesn't wait for the answer. It's in his mind. What is it? Jesus has said a word here that has not been very much on his lips. Nobody talks about truth in the Roman garrisons and government agencies. But Jesus hits him. Now if he had not been impressed with Jesus, he would not have played around with these words, you know. He's a criminal. I mean, in his courts, he's a criminal. In his mind, so far as he had known up to this time, as far as Pilate knew, this is just a seditionist. That is a person that is revolting against the government, you see. He's a rabble-rouser. The Jews bring him in there as somebody who's stirring up the people against Caesar, and that's something that he can't allow. No matter what he thinks of the man, he can't allow anything to be stirred up there against the Caesars, because that's why he's there. So Pilate here has no commitment to this Jewish man other than to be a representative of the Roman government and keep the uprisings from taking place. But he's captivated. You see that? This man Pilate is captivated by Jesus. And he's entering into a discussion that he would not have entered into with anybody else. He would have gotten this nasty business out of the way so he could go back to bed or whatever his fascinations were at the time. But that's why I said to you, there came a turning point. In the very beginning, He wanted to get this thing out of his hair and get on with his work. And you almost get a sneer in his voice there, you know. Get him out of here. I don't care about him or you or your laws or anything else. Just get him out of my sight. But that's not so now. I told you there came a turning point where he now, having confronted Jesus, was going to work with him to try and get him free. And this is what he's doing. When Jesus is confronted directly, something takes place. Whether you're talking about a simple Samaritan woman or a Pharisee of the Sanhedrin or a courtier of the royal court, as one that Jesus encountered, or the fisherman, or the Roman governor. Whoever confronts Jesus directly, whatever their background, whatever their need, whatever their state of ignorance, if I may say so, of the things of God. I don't mean that they are ignorant people, but I mean people are ignorant of the things of God. Whatever their state, when Jesus is confronted, something takes place. The tragedy in much of Christendom today, the tragedy is that people all too often confront the rules and the religion and the regulations and the theologies, and they don't just confront Jesus Christ. And religious ideas will not turn anyone on except some highbrow intellectual. And that very vaguely, but you don't turn people on with religious ideas. You don't bring them to Christ through argumentation and debate. You don't appeal to their reason or rationale. All you can do is confront them with Jesus Christ. And that's all that we try to do. And we're sitting in that judgment hall with Pilate here. And we're watching a man confront Jesus Christ and go from a point of total indifference and cynicism to a point of great and intense interest. And we are talking about a man who has lived with rottenness all of his life. He's a hard man. Make no mistake, Pilate was a hard man, or he would never have been in that spot. We had some men down there today, hard men that we talked to, men off the street, men of the street, men who would rather be on the street than in the suburbs. Down there in the ghettos of Los Angeles, there are these men that are down there in what people call Skid Row, and they probably would call it the same thing. They're in a social element that they have grown accustomed to, and they have been able to survive in it by being hard. And people who think that they're going to do them a favor by taking them out into the nice suburbs will be making a grave mistake. And they've heard every story you can ever hear. The men in that meeting that have been in those meetings time after time after time, their ears have been pounded and pounded with clever religious maxims and platitudes and berating and bedeviling and all the rest of it that the typical religionist will come in the pulpit and do. They heard it all. But the Spirit of God got through to some today, and they were willing to come and take Christ in their hearts. Because when you confront Jesus Christ, there's something there. Now he tries to get him released. And in one of the accounts it says, from that time forth he sought to release him. He says, well, he saw an easy out here. And he says, well, after all, it's the Passover time, and there was a custom there that at Passover, a special dispensation of the Roman government was that they would release to them any one prisoner that they had. If there happened to be a favorite prisoner, the leader of some group or something that had been imprisoned, they would release him for them. And so he thought, well, obviously these people aren't going to go this far. They've got a way out. I've got a way out. I'll just remind them that this is the time to release a prisoner. We'll release him, and that'll be all there is to it. He didn't see how they could possibly have enough against him to care whether we release him or not. But of course, he didn't reckon with the wrath of the Jewish people here. He asked them if they would not want him to release the king of the Jews. Now, notice this. He says, do you want me to release the king of the Jews? There is now no longer question in his mind. You see how this turns? The very first question Pilate asks is, are you the king of the Jews? Then he gradually shifts. Then he says, finally, you are indeed the king of the Jews, aren't you? There is still a little question. But now he says, do you want me to release the king of the Jews? He was persuaded by that time. He knew who Jesus was. Now, again and again, people confront Jesus, and they know who he is, and they've been touched by him, but they turn away. And that's where hardness sets in. Now, we'll see what Pilate did. Because we do not have knowledge that Pilate became a follower of Jesus as Nicodemus did. See, now Nicodemus, confronting Jesus, became an ardent follower.